Hello and welcome back to another episode of Challenger City TM, where we explore the innovative spirit required to drive the transformation in Toronto. I'm your host, Ian Montgomery, and today I've got a guest who is uniquely positioned at the crossroads of finance and design. So please join me in welcoming Jordan Ostupchuk. We're going to get into the topic of capital design, and if you're wondering what that means, well, you're in for a treat, keep listening. He brings a unique perspective on how institutional capital can be leveraged to drive urban innovation and transformation. Jordan's work focuses on solving complex problems by blending the investment rigor required to go along with the creative logic. We'll explore topics like capital design, the role of institutional investors in shaping cities, and how Toronto can harness these insights to become a true challenger city. So here is a conversation with Jordan Ostupchuk. Jordan, thank you so much for being the next guest up on this Challenger CTO series. I feel like you're going to be great because one of the things I was taught very, very early in my career was always follow the money if you want to find change. So you're kind of the money man when it comes to some of the people we're speaking to in this series. But to get us into it, I'm very excited to talk about the topic of capital design. But really, like, do the usual thing. Let's give the listeners a bit of your background, a bit of your story of how we came to be here.
Sure. Thanks for having me. And I think the quote you might be attributing to one of the most famous bank robbers when they asked him, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. But we're talking about it in a different context. So I'm Jordan and I'm a capital designer. And you might be asking, what does that mean? So depending on who I'm with, you'll find out either the token capitalist in a room full of designers or the token designer in a room full of capitalists. And it took me about 10 years to realize that it was okay to be a yes and person. So all of the challenges that we as humans created for ourselves really span multiple disciplines and timescales and systems. So it didn't feel natural to me to be limited to one profession and bring sort of a deep, very narrow viewpoint on these massively complex challenges like cities. So it functionally means I've always pursued the problem, not the profession, right? So if we can frame the problem correctly, I think we're 80% of the way there to solving it. And this concept really applied to my career as well. I never set out, you know, to be a speechwriter for a CEO or build a pension innovation team or run an infrastructure strategy function or do a PhD. These are all just like necessary responses to challenges that I uncovered with the way that the world works, right? Just thinking like, hey, this thing doesn't make sense. What can we do about it? There's either going to be tools out there that can help us solve the problem in a new way. So we can go find them. Or if the tools don't exist, you can go create them. I can give you two examples of that. So first is where we needed new tools, and you'll be very familiar with this one. Working at a very large real estate developer in Toronto, owned by one of the big pension funds, and this role afforded very panoramic views of the commercial real estate industry, specifically the forces acting upon it. So I got asked, you know, one day, it's like, what are we doing about innovation in real estate? And it turns out, nothing. So I got asked by the CEO, you know, basically go do something innovative in real estate. And it just so happened that this was during the rise of WeWork. So we had a really pressing problem to solve, right? This was an existential threat to commercial real estate. And it was the first of one of these many unstructured problems that sort of landed on my desk. And this is when you and I, Ian, first worked together, really designing these customer value props for these fast-growing startups who would eventually be at the tall office towers. And there's a couple of hilarious anecdotes, which are probably indicative of how, you know, this group thinks about the city. And we realized that one big bank had signed a 15-year lease, right, which was for longer than Facebook had existed at the time. So we're like, how could you possibly anticipate a future that far in advance? But it was also an opportunity for us to turn commercial real estate on its head. And remember, we printed out two leases. One of them took up the entire panoramic glass window, and it was like 75 pages, and the other one was just a single page. And it was a fun project that opened up my eyes initially to the power of design in commercial settings, and also started to clue me in into the role of institutional capital in shaping our cities and how we live and work. And to your point, it started to say like, okay, maybe there's a trail of money here that we can follow. So through this experience, talking about might there be tools out there, I went to go get a master's at OCAT, Masters of Design and Strategic Foresight and Innovation, so I could better understand these design tools and kind of apply what we had done in the sprint over and over. Now, that kind of takes you up to a certain point, but you reach a limit of where the tools can reasonably start to address some of these challenges. The second example is, okay, what if the tools don't exist or they've never been applied in this new context? So through that journey of having spent over a decade in institutional capital and pensions at that point, it was my job to think about the portfolio of the future. but something, again, started to just not feel right. Like the types of deals coming across this asset class didn't really match the asset class or any other asset class. And the more exciting the deal, the more mental gymnastics we needed to do to make it fit. So I was talking to my peers in other departments, other plans, and it's just basically this new information that the world was presenting us didn't fit the old pipes, right? The old pipes of how institutional investors look at the world. So I wanted to solve this problem because it's not just my problem. Basically, this is an everyone problem. And I wanted to understand the design, which I knew I had already figured out how to make sense of the type of complexity and really help institutional investors make decisions in uncertainty in this very specific world of institutional capital. So that's when I went to go do my PhD in design at Institute of Design in Chicago, looking specifically at the role of design in institutional capital allocation. And the result of all that is capital design.
So I'll ask you the really stupid question here. What's capital design?
Great question. So let me take a step back and answer the question, what's design? Which I'm uniquely positioned to realize that design, for all its skills in communicating things to the world, has done an absolutely terrible job of communicating its value to the world.
Funny that.
The way that I think about design is, on one hand, it's one of the most innate human instincts. It's our ability to imagine a different future and go to do something about it. But it's also super widespread and actually very powerful. So everything between production and consumption has been designed, all the stuff around you and I, the way we're talking to each other. Design has had this massive impact on the 20th century through industrialization, and it can have the same impact on the 21st century through investment, because design understands the human elements behind the things that we're investing. So I think very apt for talking about cities, because after all, everything we do as customers, and they've got needs and they've got wants and desires, and these people aren't just customers, but community members and voters. So you can think about design as helping us create new options before we go and make a decision. So that's the design component, but it had never really been introduced to institutional capital allocation. So what I wanted to do was see if they could be combined, blending the investment rigor with creative logic to solve, you know, institutions' most pressing challenge. So after 3 years of case studies and interviewing people, came up with a couple design capabilities that are uniquely suited to the very specific and rigorous world of institutional capital, and just applying some creative thinking.
And in terms of institutional capital, I think some people understand what that means. And ultimately, so much of how the world goes around is reliant on this slightly opaque world. Give us a little bit of a lens into some of the challenges that are being faced by institutional capital and how design is helping to change that into the future.
Yeah, institutional capital, people probably have an inkling, either if they're in a pension or they, you know, read the news and they see this pension plan owns this thing. But once you start peeling back the layers, there's over $100 trillion of institutional capital, right? And it forms the literal, the physical and social infrastructure of our cities and towns and our day-to-day life, right? Everything from like veterinarians to skills to power plants to water treatment plants. Like it's, once you start to follow the money, it's everywhere. And I've argued before that institutional capital actually will be the most transformative force of the 21st century, just by nature of the ownership, right? And by nature of the problems that society needs to solve, is greater than any one individual country to do it. And this puts institutional capital in this paradox in a deeply, deeply uncomfortable place, right? Institutional investors are very conservative and risk averse by nature, which is good because they need to be around for decades, if not centuries. But yet, because of their role kind of stepping in to solve some of these bigger challenges, they're trying to solve things never done before with tools not suited for the job. So if you're talking about what are the challenges they're facing, you know, they're being asked to solve for things that just like don't fit in traditional asset classes, don't fit in risk metrics, don't fit in governance processes, and they aren't able to have the conversations about, you know, what is institutional capital's role in a challenger city. There's just no mechanism for that ever to make sense.
I think it's that interesting thing is that as a Brit growing up, you kind of had this thing of, every so often in the news, you heard about a weird and wonderful thing that was owned by a Canadian pension plan, whether it was teachers or municipal workers or the feds or whatever it might be. The Channel Tunnel was the famous example of, hang on, how the hell do the Canadians own this? We don't even know anything about the Canadians, which makes this world super, super fascinating to me. And then when we think about it in the realm of a challenger city, like when I started out this series, I used a line from Olivia Chow of Toronto is broke. So this is where it really highlights how important institutional capital is going to be in maintaining, rebuilding, creating the future infrastructure, not just Toronto, but basically any city. How does that compete when it comes to institutional capital cultures that are probably quite used to being the, here's the thing that we can safely invest in and we're pretty confident that we'll see this return over the next long-term period.
Yeah, you nailed it. It comes down to being able to say, I don't know or I can't know. And those are two things that are antithetical to being an institutional investor. I mean, a lot of how they view the world is trying just to solve for should we buy or not, right? What's the return? And there's a very specific framework that they apply. But we need to make decisions. And this is not just institutional investors. It just so happens that the types of decisions they're making have pretty significant impact. I think this is where design can help because we need to get people out of their current mental models. I'll put your listeners into the shoes of an institutional investor for a second just to see practically how this works. So institutional investors view the world through asset class. Like these are kind of like asset class goggles. These are the predominant mental model. And an asset class is really just a bucket that you can fit bits of the world into, right? You've got real estate, infrastructure, private equity, and so on. The challenge is that these asset classes don't really match the way that the world works anymore. They worked maybe 30 years ago, but this was before everything was, you know, digitized, decarbonized, and decentralized. So all of these asset classes are really an implicit view of the future, implicit expectations about what commercial real estate, for example, can and should be. And this gets us the boring architecture, even more boring food and beverage options. And that's all this marketing material that highlights like AAA, landmark, building, center ice, located close to all major transit without actually doing anything like that extends a foot beyond that property line. So the challenge for them is like, how do you break out of this? Like you still have to deliver a return and be a fiduciary. And that is extremely important, but there are different ways that you can go about solving that problem. And the way that I'm thinking about it is capital design can help reframe these central investment theses of some of these asset classes, right? So you can have a more productive and nuanced conversation about what commercial real estate in a downtown core can and should be, and how to integrate, you know, maybe a challenger city mindset in an investment.
Historically, we probably looked at much commercial real estate as being, there's the shopping mall, there's the office tower, there's maybe the office tower above the shopping mall. This is, like you said, how we get to the sort of generic boxes. When the world changes, with the situation we're in now, where lots of places, people don't go to the office 5 days a week, in many companies, you don't go to the office at all. What happens when the world changes in terms of that asset class no longer looks like what it looked like when you were wearing those goggles 7 years ago? How does design help for that going forward when it comes to, we don't want to assume commercial real estate is a bad investment because the type of commercial real estate we've had perhaps is underperformed. Instead, we're transforming and redesigning what we mean by that.
Yeah, it really helps you reimagine, like, what does this thing do for me in my portfolio? Like, what characteristics do I need? Or what characteristics am I investing in when I'm investing in commercial real estate? And how does that fit with all the other things I need to solve for? So through design, it's at a very simple level, allows you to distill things down to what matter. Just like ask better questions. So like, what's the problem? Why is this problem so hard to solve in the first place? Can we reframe this problem to open up new solutions? And like in doing so, figure out what we're actually solving. Because then you can start to throw those into a bit of a future scenario-based mindset and like anticipate how these things turn out. And you just need to treat people as they are, not as you wish them to be in these future scenarios, right? Just by watching what people do. And I know you and I had a ton of conversations on customer behavior, but that's another characteristic of design, which is like vastly useful to most investment decisions, but just doesn't have an entry point in there. And then you can start to decide, okay, what are you actually going to do about it? Only after you've properly framed.
How much of this has been normalized so far in institutional investors? Are we still at the cutting edge of this? Are we just seeing sort of early adopters really kind of getting their heads around capital design? Or is it still a sort of educational piece of, we're still really teaching people how to see the world differently or redesign the pipes?
Yeah, it's not about going out and pitching capital design as such. It's more of, okay, if we think this way, it's a way of seeing the world. And if you see the world in a different way, you can start to invest in a different way. And there's a ton of great examples of pension funds, like APG, a big Dutch pension fund, changing their, like the definition of infrastructure to be around like quality and quality of life, circular economy. Like that's now an asset class. So imagine that not just the different things that they can invest in, but the different types of risk, investment, governance, questioning, analysis that you would need to do to get to an outcome that says, yeah, I can see a return in a way that this makes sense. Like it's happening. It's so one of the quotes, I think this might be from Buckminster Fuller, but learned it in design school, pops up all the time, is like, to be a designer is to be a first-class noticer. Just have your radar on, and anything that doesn't make sense, either the world wrong or your model of the world is wrong. But either way, it's a great place to focus and say, huh, I wonder why that is. And then if you get really deep into a particular context, in my space, it's institutional investment. There's a lot of stuff that you see these workarounds, like risk metrics that kind of like hack a proxy to get at something, or an investment decision process that tries to paper over this lack of uncertainty. Like, let's probe there, right? And the right's not always going to be the answer, but I find it's just reframing of like, what are we actually trying to accomplish by doing this thing? And is there a different way we can do it? Or is there a totally different set of outcomes that we're looking?
There's something quite interesting around like good design done really well often can't justify itself in advance. You sort of have to go do it to start to build the case for change. And then suddenly a lot of things become obvious. So that thing of like, that's a bit weird. What does this make me notice or think about doing differently? I think it's really interesting that the field of institutional investing can be the thing that changes the world over the next 10, 20 years, perhaps more so than anything. Because I would always have thought of them being the bean counters that are like, before you want me to invest in a different type of asset class, or before you want me to change my like the way that I've always done something, you kind of have to prove it to the bean counters and lawyers. Whereas actually what design is doing is helping you make that case for change without necessarily having the perfect finance or risk case effectively. Is that kind of fair?
You can think of it like practicing judo, right? Where you're trying to use your opponent's momentum against them. And I don't want to frame it in adversarial terms, but the whole reason why I was so attracted to capital, which is probably a counterintuitive place for designers to focus, is because that's where the momentum is. And so much of when I was doing the dissertation and just in my career is not try to insert design where it doesn't belong. It's actually recognizing that these processes are incredibly good and incredibly efficient at doing a very specific thing, which is like optimizing, taking a bunch of conflicting data, narrowing it down, and like making a decision. Like capital allocation at the institutional levels is an amazing and super robust process. So it's like, how can we actually use that in our favor? And what design is doing is just kind of inserting new information that probably wouldn't constitute what investors think of as data, you know, stuff from the future, like social sentiment, all that stuff. And saying like, if we add this to your investment process, what comes out at the end? And we've seen numerous times, like once investors see something as kind of the most rational and return generating thing to do, they'll do it. They will beat a path to do that. So that's where I have a ton of confidence, because in the conversations that I've had, it's like, oh yeah, like if we can just view our portfolio through this different risk lens, the things that we thought were crazy actually make a lot of sense. And then we're just going to do it. Like there's no convincing needed. So it's not about selling design. It's just about saying, hey, can we collectively expose the trade-offs that we're implicitly making, agree on what we're actually solving for? See, there's probably different ways to accomplish it. And doing it in a way that's really complementary to our strengths, boop, like you've got a path to the door there.
Who's great at this? Who do you look to and go, they're the standard bearer, they're the poster child? Is it a thing that the Canadians are good at? Is it something that we're still sort of looking over elsewhere and thinking we need to fast follow? Where's it working well?
We could be good at it. So for context, Canadian plans fall under this idea of the Maple model, which is strong, independent governance from the government, really good professional in-house teams that can pay accordingly, in-house decision-making, and the ability to invest really in anything around the world. We've been doing that for a while, and a lot of other countries have looked to us and kind of developed their own models and ways that work for them. And it's funny because the Canadian institutional investors don't actually look at each other as peers. Like they'll be looking to like the Blackstones or the GICs or whomever in the world. So everyone's looking to Canada, but Canada's looking elsewhere. But with success comes a bit of complacency where you're like, we've been so good for so long. What's the impetus for change? And you're starting to see some, you know, like Dutch plans, Swedish plans, whomever, taking it the next step further. But by and large, we are, I think Canada is a pension leader, like in terms of, especially Toronto, just being home base to all the pensions, like we're Silicon Valley for startup, like we are a pension hub. And there's a lot of really, really specific, very valuable knowledge here.
Is it unfair to say that when it comes to, I want to like dig into Toronto as a challenger city, but there's been quite a lot in the news around Canadian funds don't necessarily invest in Canada, but will they get a bit more excited about investing in internationally? Is that fair? Is that true?
The part that's true about that statement is they've been getting a lot of press about it.
Okay.
Also, their response to it is also true to say, just like statistically speaking, if they were investing proportionally in Canada as a share of the global economy, they're like way over investing. Because Canada's like 3% of the global economy, and a lot of them have, you know, somewhere between 20 and 40%. And again, like they're saying, hey, look, independent governance is what has made us so successful. We are investing to pay pensions well into the future, right? So we have a return hurdle that we need to meet. Like, as fiduciaries, the law says, like, that's the focus that we have. It's not to promote a domestic mandate. Not to say that you couldn't have a fund, like a sovereign wealth fund, like many countries do, with the sole purpose of promoting domestic aims. It's just a completely different setup. And I just trying to make one fund do multiple things, it really conflicts and makes them do two things poorly.
Yeah. I think the thing that sort of drew my attention to it was probably about a year or so ago when you had the REM opening up in Montreal. Sorry to bring it to transit, as I often do. But like, that's kind of operates under a quite a different funding and development model. And it's by no means perfect. And it has a hell of a lot of controversy and politics attached to it. But it's a really interesting example of how institutional investors can invest in a city and transform how that city works, hopefully for the better. I think that's, to me, where I come to for my wife. Like, when I'm projecting onto you, but when I think of Toronto as a challenger city, this is where we can do really interesting things with money from different places to reimagine critical pieces of infrastructure for how the city works. But maybe before we go into that, I should get your view of what challenger city before we go down this rabbit hole.
What is a challenger city? Just a point on what you mentioned about the REM and the case. I think they've done a good job of being clear what they're solving, right? So like, we're solving what we also have a domestic, a Quebec mandate, and it's very clear. So when people bring an investment to the committee, like, that's a criteria. So it doesn't really matter what outcome you're solving for, as long as everyone is on the same page. I'll give you an example about where, if people just assume that you're all on the same page, but you're not, leads to conflicts where most pensions need to pay pensions. So they, like, cash and income is a pretty significant component, but yet a lot of members or the public say, hey, you should be investing in all this energy transition. Also a very noble cause. Those two things often conflict in reality, right? Like, the ability to generate cash and pay pensions is usually not the type of investment that require a ton of capital and may pay off 10, 15 years into the future. Again, neither is right or wrong, but for boards and investment committees and CIOs to say, like, okay, here's what we're solving. Here are the forces at play. Here's what we're uniquely good at, the capabilities we have. Like, just getting that on the table. And that's what design, again, is good at, is like, very simply making the invisible visible, just surfacing these trade-offs that we're making and facilitating a conversation that you could do this in a couple hours and saying, like, we're just drawing the boundaries of the decision and let's go from there. So your question of what is a challenger city? A challenger city for me is, they have a distinct aspiration for what it wants to be and a strategy to achieve it. These come in two types. You sometimes see cities that are reinventing themselves, you know, based on a previous idea or a previous identity that no longer holds, or other times they had this vision from the start. So I've had the privilege of working in a ton of cities over the last few years. I lived in LA over a decade ago. I've worked in Sydney, Singapore, London, New York, Boston, Vancouver, Montreal, like, seeing a bunch of different models. But I think Pittsburgh is a great example of reinvention, right? Their slogan is from Steel City to Smart City. It consistently ranks top in, like, green space and top 10 tech cities in the country. They really, like, solidified themselves as an autonomous driving center because of the universities. So that's one where they have a clear view. They're like, we're going to be this. We've got our natural strengths. We're going to build on that. And, like, this is our vision for the future. Singapore is a great example of having a strong vision from the start, right? They were super clear on what they were solving for. They made the trade-offs explicitly clear. And they wanted to make use of their limited and scarce resource. So those are two examples. And it comes down to having, like, a very distinct aspiration and a strategy to achieve it. So it's more than just having a vision. They're like, come, this is the place to work, live, and play. So is Toronto a challenger city? No, not yet, right? So imagine the leaders of Toronto use Roger Martin's playing to win framework.
I knew you were going to bring that up. I absolutely knew it, but I like it.
It's a good example of blending kind of the design of the business. And, you know, it's how we think over here at Fuse. So just imagine if Toronto had this winning aspiration. They understood where to play, how to win, supporting capabilities, management systems, good bit of design built in there. But you have a single page strategy for a city. So it's not a vision. It's not a plan. It's like just an honest to goodness integrated strategy for being distinct in the world. Because, yeah, like, we compete. Like, Toronto competes with other cities, town, countries. We compete with other businesses, right? We compete for people, for dollars, for prestige. So if we think about it, you know, in this infinite game mindset, the only way to win is just to keep playing. And to do that, you'd have to be constantly reinventing yourself as a city. And you have to have a plan for doing so. So that's what I think a challenger city is. And that's how I think Toronto could be a challenger city.
Where do you think it's at? Are we close to sort of being able to become that thing? Or do you think we're way back at the beginning and there's a whole lot of thinking and tough love that needs to happen first?
We need to address the boring stuff of the mechanisms and the systems by which decisions get made, right? It's like very nerdy and definitely not something that anyone's going to run for council on, but you can have a bunch of great point solutions. And I know many of your guests have these cool ideas, and there's a Bentway, there's a waterfront, or there's, you know, this particular zoning change, but structurally, like in terms of, it's similar to following the money, right? It's just a systems view on where is the system we're in and what's the highest leverage point in that system. In institutional capital, it's at the CIO level because they, you know, can allocate $1 billion here or there. At a city and sort of civic democracy level, it's the process by which decisions are made. And we can start there, and then all the downstream stuff gets a little bit easier, or at least more clear as to what we're doing and why.
I'm kind of jumping ahead of here a bit. I'd like to come to the end and do a magic wand question.
Sure.
Touching on something really interesting. So let's say we make Jordan the all-seeing, almighty dictator of the city of Toronto. Just give you some power for a little while and let's see what this guy does. Where would you go? Like, what levers would you pull? What sort of things would you be like, right, I can move the needle here while I've got some control?
So is this the magic wand question, or is this a...
I think it's kind of the magic wand question. I just mostly wanted to put you on the spot because I think you hit something really interesting around systems. And whenever we get to systems, what every conversation I've ever had around systems gets quite complicated. So I wanted to strip some of the politics out of it and be more like I think there's an interesting sort of remove the reality, put a benevolent dictator in charge and see what might happen. Not advocating this is my politics here, by the way, but you know.
Right, yeah, removing politics by inserting a benevolent dictator. Good start. So look, I would start by setting up an office for the future, right? This is like a set of trained scenario planners and future thinkers, but it's not just a fancy trend deck function. It really is something that you run all policy proposals through a pretty rigorous scenario and futures filter to see what the impact on future generations will be. It's very similar to the Congressional Budget Office to make sure that, you know, whatever's proposed actually balances the books, because this is about bringing the trade-offs and the implications to light. I think design is incredibly good at thinking about the future in a structured way. So I think if you think about like strategic sensing and just building that capability in where it's like, what's the implication now, 5 years from now, 50 years from now? But it's not just a nice to have. Like everything actually has to pass, however you want to call that, this future lens, because you're accounting for future generations. So that's how you can have this like ancestral or cathedral type thinking into what we're doing, because it's incredibly easy to be short-sighted and political. I have an example, actually. I was reading a book, phenomenal book, called Frame Innovation by Keith Dorst. And it's very similar. I'm like, how do we create new thinking by design? So a little while ago, Holland was, I think this is like in the mid-90s here. They were trying to build the high-speed train link. And they did all these impact studies, town halls, like all in the hopes that rationality would prevail. And rationality did not prevail. In fact, actually, rationality worked so well that it did not prevail, because ended up the planning process dragged on for 15 years, right? Until like this top-down direct route, basically someone just draw through a straight line, was opposed by the government, sort of like worst of all options. But the best part is like once they actually started construction, the government very quickly realized this route was clearly flawed and started the consultation process again because they had a little bit of leeway. And then the government did a congressional inquiry, and there was findings that, you know, more research at the very beginning should have been done, and which is why they're absolutely totally wrong in this sense, because conventional problem solving had clearly reached like the end of its utility. And just the fact that they've got more research up front would demonstrate their complete inability to manage just like new types of problem, because the challenge here is like they thought the problem was about the train. The problem actually was not about the train. So fast forward it a bit, and once they got a bit of kind of design mindedness in there, they reframed the discussion. They realized pretty quickly that if you framed it about quality of life for the people that were impacted by the train, they saw residents willing to make compromises, right? So they saw this deep relationship between the land and people that had it in the family for generations, because the impacts on life could be compensated in other ways that allowed people to just take a more human lens versus being forced into this like super adversarial, you're putting me to defend, get my backup over something that I have to do or not. So Jordan, as maybe benevolent dictator, there's this like future thinking center, which allows you to reframe things and be like, if the problem were framed as X, we can actually do ABC.
So let's talk about the problem. What do you see as the the most important or the single most important challenges that Toronto's currently suffering from and how capital design can help to solve for it?
I think it's just, we don't know what we're solving for. So we're trying to do a bunch of stuff. The example that I had, this is what caused me to go do a master's thesis in this, is spending a lot of time in church basements, going through like development proposals and charrettes. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with planners and developers when I was working with the real estate developer. And the consultation process was, I think, designed specifically to produce bad outcomes, because it gives people an opportunity to oppose something without giving up anything in return, right? It's actually not an exchange. It's just like, I have no incentive to be constructive here, and I have every incentive to be obstructive. So it's not any one thing, right? It's not like, oh, if we only widened the road here, or added a bike lane there, or made this park here. Like, it goes back to the decision-making process. So one of the ways I was thinking about solving this at a conceptual level was this idea of the autopoetic city. So this concept in systems like autopoiesis, how to create a city that creates itself. So what if we replace this very centralized top-down urban planning with just a set of mechanisms that can create the emergent systems that we're looking for? So instead of these master plans that utterly fail to anticipate human behavior, there's a lot of good case studies from around the world, like Brasilia is a great example. Or there's case studies to the counterfactual, where if you have no urban planning, it's also not great, like goes Nigeria, or even like Houston, where they had all those floods because they said you could pave over all the floodways. It's saying like, okay, what if we took inspiration from nature? Like, forests don't have master plans, but yet they work pretty well because they're governed by a loose set of relationships, and everything is a relationship to the thing next to it. Like, there's no master plan that said the oaks are over here and this river is going to be nicely in the middle and the ferns are here. There's this architect philosopher, you may be familiar with him, your listeners probably are, is Christopher Alexander, right? And his idea of pattern languages and parts and wholes, and everything is just, everything you do is in relation to the thing next to it. So I think that's some of the challenge, right? It's just like the basic way that we make decisions. There you go. James C. Scott, Think Like a State, as you held up. A perfect one. Like, that's a great example, but how we impose our own administrative mindset onto the real world problems, which is not a great mapping.
It's interesting as well, like, as you go through these things that you talk about, the top-down Brasilia, Chandigarh, Corbusier's vision for Paris, not great. Then you talk about the bottom-up, like the forest. Actually, lots of forests can be made better by a little bit of human intervention. There was a thing the other week about Canada, like forests that we leave alone and then forests that we have some human intervention so we can burn some things, and then that clears room for more growth and they become better carbon sinks. Like, nerdy stuff, but like, you want something in the middle. That system is, that's how you get to the good stuff.
Yeah, you can think about it, but we're naturally drawn to cities and even individual structures that display this type of like iterative thinking. Like, old Roman cities were just, they have a central square and then they just evolved outwards around it, and everything was in relation to the building next to it. And it has so much charm and it's all unique and it's really interesting and it just all fits. And there's no master plan there. Or these old kind of farmhouses that you can see the original structure and then they added something on the side and then they added, but everything is in relation to each other and it gives it so much character versus like a McMansion. We're just naturally drawn to it. I don't think it's any more difficult than what we're doing, but there's a way that we can do it. And this might be one of the more out there ideas, but if you've heard of quadratic voting.
You're going to have to explain quadratic voting because I don't know what that is.
Okay. So here, Jordan, the hypothetical mayor of Toronto, trying to fix the process by which decisions are made using, you know, design and other like really interesting mechanisms that help us produce totally different outcomes by starting at the way that we make decisions. Quadratic voting is based on the concept that one vote for one issue doesn't make a lot of sense, because a vote on an issue that you don't care about is a wasted vote. So what if you could save your votes up, you know, an allotment of vote credits, and you put them all towards something that you really care about? So like a new bike lane or a new express lane, you know, super tall tower or a low rise or like better schools or better transit. But the quirk here is that the cost of the vote goes up quadratically. So like one vote equals one credit, two or four or three or nine. And so on and so forth. So like everyone gets an allotment of credits. They're non-transferable. You can have a multiplier based on how close you physically live to the thing at hand, because all politics is local. We've actually seen this. I mean, it's been used in the Colorado House of Representatives. It's been used in Brazil to reach consensus on tax amendments. And it is a way for people to express intensity of opinion on something they really care about, but there's a cost. And then like doing so on this means you kind of forego the opinion on that. It can work directly with our, like, whether that's local development planning, the approval process, or all the way up to sort of like how we actually have a debate on, like, do you care about saving 5 minutes off your transit times? Great. Like, you could go all in on the Gardner extension, but you've given up the ability to vote on whether this rehab clinic should go here or whether this park should go there. And those things, those mechanism tweaks, are up how I think Toronto becomes a challenger city, right? Thinking differently about how we make decisions because we've reframed our challenge. Like, the winning ambition would be, like, Toronto actually does cities differently.
When I came to Canada, I would often get this thing of, oh, we really need people's perspective who've been elsewhere. And then you get here and everybody I know who's come from elsewhere has hit this wall at some point where someone goes, oh, but you don't really understand Canada, we're different. And there's something slightly ingrained in the soul of the country that does this. And in some ways, I look at that and go, that's brilliant. Like, Canada's not just copying somewhere else. It's trying to stand on its own, do its own thing, have an identity. Then at the same time, we often then just go, what was somebody else done 10 years ago? Let's copy that and play catch up.
Yeah.
I love that idea of, okay, you want to oppose a thing. What are you giving up for that? Like, if you want to oppose the Gardner being expanded, or you want to oppose some bike lanes, that means you don't get to say, I love that idea. That's like, you also can't be against a new transit line downtown for whatever it might be. I kind of love that sort of, if you're going to say no to lots of things, you're not adding any value, but you're well within your rights to oppose something that you really don't like. It makes the city additive, not subtractive or stagnant.
Exactly. It always ends up finding an equilibrium. A good example would be, like, at a simple level, this is how I describe it to my son, is the cost of ice cream. Imagine the cost of ice cream was inversely correlated to the temperature outside. So really hot, ice cream's $10. If it's 0 degrees, it's like free ice cream. Right? They're always going to be selling some ice cream, and they're probably going to be selling an average amount every day. It's like an interesting mechanism to get at. Rather than trying to sell as much ice cream as possible, they're trying to sell an even and steady amount of ice cream because you probably have less waste. The same thing goes for cities. And to your point about, let's go ask a bunch of people what worked in another city, doesn't really make much sense, because everything in a city should be done in relation to the thing next to it. So, like, you actually need that hyper-local. Like, what's going to make this individual community a little bit better? And then a little bit better, a little bit better. The challenge is, like, how do you plan for some of the bigger things like urban infrastructure, where I think that's where the institutional capital come in, where you can start to see some of these trends and then, okay, like, there's a general movement out towards this way. Let's get the power lines. Let's get the water, the subway in there. But it's not like a massive amount of work or change, just to think a little bit different about how we do the basic things that evolve into, oh, like, how did we end up with the decision that not a single person says was a great decision, but, like, here we are. It's because the process by which we made a choice or made a decision just, like, didn't really make any sense, or it was designed to solve a totally different purpose.
What's the view from the investor? So when they look at this, when they're thinking about what we need to see from cities, or the help we want from cities, or the case we want to make with the inhabitants of those cities, because ultimately they don't want to go and invest in a thing that's meh. I also know investors have a little bit of an ego. Like, we like things that are shiny and big and novel and innovative, et cetera. What does an investor need to see from a city to better deploy the power of capital design?
I don't think it's incumbent on the city to say, we're going to show you X, and only if we do that, then benevolent capital is going to flow in. I would argue that if investors viewed it in a different way, they would see that they should probably take the lead. Right. In my very narrow lane, going back to being the mayor, like, I'd convene a conversation with the big institutional investors in Toronto, and not just the real estate leaders, but the people who represent the pensioners, workers, and other infrastructure, and kind of take them through this reframing exercise to map these implicit assumptions about what the city is doing, what the city can do, and why it's doing what it's doing. Because you need to have multiple competing, essentially, visions of the future to understand, like, how yours fits in and plays out. Because as you pointed out here and on LinkedIn, like, institutional capital is already pretty well represented in these working groups, whether it's on housing or transit. The problem is that they're just coming in with the same stale perspectives, right? That's why we get nowhere. So maybe I'll take a step back and, like, why institutional capital has been so interesting to me. Once you get to the highest levels, you have what's called universal owners. Like, it's a separate VIP category of institutional investors, where collectively they all own and co-own a bit of everything. So they're in this really interesting situation where they can't beat the market because they are the market. There's nothing to diversify away from or to. So now they're in this position of, like, okay, we're reliant on the health of the economy as a whole, which is in turn reliant on, like, the health of cities as a whole for our portfolio. So you would then think that, like, okay, it actually makes sense to invest directly in the things that drive city health, which drive economic health. So capital design is really helping them make that connection where it's like, this is a very material part of our investment thesis, irrespective of what a city is doing. We have the capital, we have the expertise. Like, it's very difficult to manage these super complex long-term investment projects, and institutional investors have a 25-year timeline, not three-year election cycle. So they could probably start to take lead where you need to be collaborative with the city, but it's just a different mindset where they understand the value that this brings, like having a functioning challenger city that's exciting, that's experimenting with, you know, different types of quadratic democracy, bringing people in, it's bringing a different type of people in. It's in turn raising the value, not just the commercial real estate, but the quality of life of the pensioners, like the other side of that ledger, which is arguably as important for them and something they should be solving for equally.
Because it's interesting when you talk to, when we did work together, we go and speak to pensioners from various funds across Ontario. And the only thing I really know is that they own the Leafs. And I don't think they did at the time. But it was sort of interesting, like pensioners attach themselves to the emotional thing that they can see. So if the institutional capital is going into something that the future pensioner will be like, I ride that train, I know that building, or like, I recognize that the power is coming through the grid from these people and they're investing in clean energy, blah, blah. I think there's some like serious power to that, albeit often those pensioners can be quite misguided as to knowing what assets are actually owned by whom and how they make money. But there is a brand play there.
And that's okay. I mean, all they need to worry about is like, is my pension safe? And by and large, yes, it is. But you're right, there is a brand play, but it works both ways because it gives you a little bit more social capital to operate if you're totally in line with people that you serve. And that's been the tack that some of these plans have taken. Like going back to your point on domestic investing, they say, we've talked to our members and they don't really care about the domestic angle. They just want to make sure that their pension's safe. And the way that we do that is being having the option to invest anywhere where we think we're going to get the highest risk adjusted return. So that may be Toronto. That may be Canada. They're more like, okay, Toronto and Canada, like you got to make it worth our while, which I realize is a little bit counter to what I just said about cities making it worth their while. There's probably a halfway point where institutional capital can say, okay, let's split the difference here. Like what drives economic growth? Maybe it's a combination of population growth and technological innovation. Government, you take care of population growth, we'll take care of technologically driven innovation. And together, you know, we'll have a pretty powerful combo. But again, it's not that these conversations can't happen or don't happen. What it is institutional investors are optimized to make a certain type of decision. And they're very, very good at making that certain. They're not optimized to deal with uncertainty, navigate complexity, and sort of factor in these second and third order consequences. And like looking at their portfolio as a whole, in the same way that a city should look at the city as like hearts and holes and is everything doing something good for the thing next to it, an institutional investor can look at their portfolio as a system. And I think you start to unlock new opportunities for investing in cities and, you know, whatever that means for them to have challenger cities as partners in this journey. It's super powerful.
I sort of foisted the magic one question on you early in this conversation. I think it was good because I've now got a better way of closing us out. So the first part of that is really, where can Toronto better apply capital design? Like, where does it need to prioritize, basically?
Getting super clear on what we're solving for. I think you need to do that at map all the groups that matter, map a bit of why this problem is so hard to solve. It's going to be in the frame of like a because statement, like because people care so much about the city, they're extremely emotionally invested, or because we're a physical city that we can't move, like we have geographic limitations, which makes it difficult to do X, Y, Z. Doing that at an individual level at the capital partners, city council, citizens, provincial government, it sounds stupid, but a very simple, what are we solving for? Let's agree to it. Like, here's our ambition. And then you can say like, what are we actually good at? What do we have? What do we not have? Like, you don't want to do things that are totally counter to your ability to execute or just like antithetical to who you are as a city. And I think you go from there, like, but you have to give up a certain amount of control, whether that this advice goes for city council and institutional capital. If you adopt like a principles-based approach to allowing decisions to be made at the level where they're most impactful and by the people that know the most about them, which is at the ground level, you have to give up a certain like grand vision for exactly what it's going to end up as. And you have to have confidence that like it's going to end up somewhere really good, better than it is today.
I really appreciate when the answer to some of these questions, you say it sounds stupid. I just think it sounds really sensible. It's kind of one of those obvious things that's like, actually, we don't need to. It's a complicated problem, but it's not necessarily a complicated process to go through to get to a solution to the problem. So I think when when you articulate like that, something like that, it gives me a ton of hope and confidence for the future.
That's good. Hope is the first start.
So we'll fast forward to then, let's say you and I are sitting down in 10 years time, having a similar conversation around Toronto as a challenger city. Where do you think we might be? Or what do you even just hope we'll be?
We're sitting in the headquarters of the Toronto Civic Strategic Sensing Center, where we have a robust process for thinking about the future and incorporating multiple voices and perspectives and constantly adapting, where it's not just like a singular decision, it's a repeating process. I think the city would look a lot more, like if you're flying over it, it would look a lot more jumbled. It would look less like, here's the downtown core, and then immediately here's like the sea of single family low-rise homes. It wouldn't be like uniform of mid-rise residential, but you'd see a little bit more variation. It would feel like the city's bubbling, like there's more organic because, you know, people could add additions onto their homes and things could go where they need to because they've gotten the blessing of the people, because there's a really interesting way of rewarding people for giving something up and having a cost for when you do want to take something. So I'd hope that we can say the city looks a lot more like a forest than it does a Lego set.
I love the analogy. It's interesting because you touched on Pittsburgh early on in this as like a city that sort of reinvented itself. And I would totally back that as a challenger. Pittsburgh feels a wee bit like that. Like you can see the old bits, that you can see the old growth, you can see the rust belt, you can see the shiny new beacons around the city. And you can see the bits that they're still just working on making better. But like you have this vibe of hope around it, of I can kind of get the feel of where this place is going. I think that's just they're just ahead of Toronto in terms of reinventing themselves. And maybe they're a much lower load than Toronto's ever been. Yeah. So I love them as an example.
And just because Toronto is not necessarily a challenger city right now, doesn't mean it's not a good city. It is a good city with a lot going for it. And we can be hard on ourselves at times, but there is a lot of hope. Like Canada and Toronto specifically is like the hub of globally recognized and respected institutional capital. Like maybe we anchor around that because there's a lot of stuff there that we don't give ourselves credit for doing. And we're trying to solve a bunch of individual problems without scaling it up and saying like, why are these problems happening? How did we cause these problems ourselves? Are there ways that we can think a little bit differently from them? So my hope is that capital design just becomes a thing you do just like accounting, right? It's a relatively boring function because it's part of how you make good decisions, right? And it's not going to supersede anything. But the types of leaders that we have, by and large, come from the analytical school. Right? You've got your CFAs and your MBAs, and that's a style of thinking that's very successful in certain contexts. But it would be my hope that city leaders, institutional investors, you know, like imagine the CIO as design. What is that? Where they're more of a synthetic and integrated thinker, and they're just naturally comfortable with complexity and shifting around what it means to be an asset class. Like you can balance being a fiduciary, but you can also understand, hey, there's a role for me in the place that I'm headquartered in as part of the fabric of civic society. That really makes a lot of sense for the business that I'm running now and 25 years into the future. That's my hope.
I was listening to a thing yesterday that had our friend Rory Sutherland on it, but talking about how in the future he hopes that he'll see a railway line where the person leading of what that railway line is going to look like would be Johnny Ive. Rather than it being like a treasury accountant, it's like a globally famous designer thinking, what problem am I really solving here?
So do you remember we did that with the real estate people? We got them all in a room and one of the orthodoxies was, elevators can only go up and down. Like, what if elevators could go sideways? That all of a sudden changes everything you know about infrastructure. It changes everything you know about architecture. It changes everything you know about leasing, right? Because which buildings are the most valuable? And it's things like that where you start to flip these orthodoxies and you're like, huh.
I think it's funny. When we got to know each other, we were flipping these orthodoxies in the property business. Then when we worked on the pension thing, Rory's book had just come out, and I think, like I read it, I was like, oh, you have to read this. Then we're in a realm where we've now started to think about like applying designers to like big pieces of infrastructure in ways that traditionally have been left to the investors and the accountants. But like, I actually think in 10 years time, if we have this conversation again, you've done the PhD, you'll be leaving me to go like teach a class on how Toronto transformed itself. So that's my hope for the future.
To our shared future, Ian, to our shared future.
Jordan, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down and talk about this. Like, it stands out. It's different to some of the conversations we've had so far. So I think that this sort of follow the money side of things is going to be massive. So I appreciate that.
Appreciate the time. Thanks for the great questions.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Challenger City TO podcast. You can find written up versions of all these interviews, as well as a history of the other podcasts we've done to date, if you go to challengercityto.substack.com. We'll see you again for another episode very soon. Thanks.
Bye-bye.